This is His Holiness Sri Dayanandas Goswami in Athens, Ohio, April
9, 2008. My first song. Okay, so we have Bhagavad Gita. Ramchandra, can you join us?
Yes, I'll join us. Just one second. Is Joel in the chair?
So, we're reading from Prabhupada's Bhagavad Gita as it is. We're going to read a very interesting text. Chapter 13, text 1, text 21, on two levels of causality. So, sin to be made into a major action, motion picture. So, thank you. Yes, summer blockbuster here. Two levels of causality in the Bhagavad Gita. So, Prabhupada translation purports the translation, which in the Sanskrit is Karya Karana Kartatve Ketu Prakriti Uchate Purusha Sukha Dukha Nam Bhuktritve Ketu Uchate. Any questions? So, Prabhupada's translation. Ryan?
Yeah.
No problem. So a few good six left. So, Prabhupada's translation in the Gita. Nature is said to be the cause of all material causes and effects, whereas the living entity is the cause of the various sufferings and enjoyments in this world. I'll read Prabhupada's first word and then we'll talk about this. Different manifestations of body, like in this room, and senses among the living entities are due to material nature. There are 8,400,000 different species of life, and these varieties are creations of the material nature. They arise from the different sensual pleasures of the living entity who thus desires to live in this body or that. When one is put into different bodies, one enjoys different kinds of happiness and distress. One's material happiness and distress are due to the body and not to oneself, as one is. In one's original state, there is no doubt of enjoyment. Therefore, that is one's real state, spiritual state. Because of the desire to lord it over material nature, one is in the material world. In the spiritual world, there is no such thing. The spiritual world is pure, but in the material world, everyone is struggling hard to acquire different kinds of pleasures for the body. It might be more clear to state that this body is the effect of the senses. The senses are instruments for gratifying desire. Now, the sum total, body and instrument senses, are offered by material nature, and as will be clear in the next verse, the living entity is blessed or damned with circumstances according to one's past desire and activity. According to one's desires and activities, material nature places one in various residential quarters. The being in himself as the cause of obtaining such residential quarters and one's attendant enjoyment or suffering. Once placed in some particular kind of body, one comes under the control of nature, because the body, being matter, acts according to the laws of nature. At that time, the living entity has no power to change that law. Suppose an entity is put into the body of a dog. As soon as one is put into a dog's body, one must act like a dog. One cannot act otherwise. And if the living entity is put into the body of a hog, one is forced to eat stool and to act like a hog. Similarly, if the living entity is put into the body of a demigod, one must act according to that body. This is the law of nature. But in all circumstances, the super soul is with the individual soul. That is explained in the Vedas, the Mundaka Upanishad, as follows: Dva Suparana Sayuja Sakaya. The Supreme Lord is so kind upon the living entity that he always accompanies the individual soul, and in all circumstances is present as the super soul, Paramatma. So, Prabhupada's purport. First of all, I'll try to explain one thing Prabhupada said, which I found quite intriguing, and then go to the Sanskrit and look at the Sanskrit very closely, what's being said here. Prabhupada said that, let's see if I can find it now. It might be more clear to state that this body is the effect of the senses. Consider our bodies. Although other people may respond to us in a particular way, like, what kind of face do you have? Are you just a pretty face? Or, what's the shape of your body? How old are you? What race is your body? And, people sort of unconsciously go through a little checklist when they meet other people. But that is how people experience us. Our bodies become the objects of other people's subjective experience. But if you consider how you experience the world, let's say a person that has the integrity not to merely see oneself through the eyes of others, like, however people see me, that's how I see myself. Not a great idea. And we should not be completely oblivious, because if we're fortunate, we may have good friends that actually tell us the truth, things we need to hear. But, so, let's say selectively, reasonably, appropriately, we can accept good advice from other people who may have some insight into our situation. But we cannot reflexively, by reflexively I mean like a knee-jerk response, just a reflex, unthinking reflex. In that sense, we cannot simply reflexively just think we are whatever anyone tells us we are. So in terms of how we experience our own life, how we experience ourselves, not how other people see us, basically we spend almost all of our time pursuing pleasure and trying to avoid pain or discomfort. That may be physical pleasure and pain, it may be emotional pleasure and pain, but that's basically what we're doing down here on earth. So what pleases us and what pains us has a lot to do with the kind of senses we have. For example, some people enjoy certain kinds of visual objects. Other people find those same visual objects disgusting. And the same is true for sounds, music, different tastes of music. One person's music is another person's insufferable noise. The same is true for food, all these things. Yeah, everyone has their own taste. Everyone has their own sense of what is attractive and what is repulsive. So, and of course, there's our consciousness, our mind. I like this, I don't like that, I feel like it, I don't feel like it. So in the ancient yoga psychology, you could say, Krishna says right in the Bhagavad Gita, manakshastani indriyani, that the senses are six with the mind. The first five are the ones we all know. Seeing, hearing, touching, tasting, and smelling. Let's not leave out smelling. So those are the five basic senses.
which in Sanskrit are called Gyanendriya, which means they are knowledge senses. In this ancient culture, they also talked, because senses, the word for senses, indriya, means something like powers. Powers, so therefore, they also talk about karmendriya, the action senses, or the action powers, which are the arms or hands, you know, all this stuff. And the legs, the speech, and then the two below the belt, front and back. So, those are considered to be the five actions, five senses that or powers that perform acts in the world, but the five powers that gather knowledge are what we call the five senses. Now, Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita these senses are six, shashta, Spanish seis, English six, shashta, with the mind, because the mind is sort of like the clearinghouse for the senses. I forget, I read something the other day. I said it in Back to Garden magazine. So that's some useful information. That at every moment there are like thousands and thousands, if not millions, of bits of data coming in. Because let's say right now you're looking at something, you're concentrating on it, your ears are still there. Your ears are still working and all kinds of sounds are coming in. You are just not paying attention to those. If you think about it. Otherwise, you couldn't focus. In other words, if you had no power to selectively prioritize all the data coming in, you would basically be eligible for government scholarship, and all your financial worries would be over. So, the ability to function rationally, or just coherently, sanely, depends on this ability, which we don't even think about it. Millions of bits of information are coming in through all of our senses. There's all kinds of memory things, and something in you, there is a power in you that is organizing and sorting out all that stuff and saying to your ear, for example, not now, dude, and saying to the eyes, okay, let's take a closer look. Can I get a close-up shot on this one so you... So the sort of the administrator, that coordinating power inside of you is the mind. And in the yoga psychology, it's understood that is the mind. So, therefore, the essence of your existence, if you think of it, is your senses and your mind, your consciousness, and your intelligence, of course, because, after all, what gives meaning to life? Beauty. But beauty, they say, is in the eye of the beholder. I won't get into a serious discussion now, a philosophical discussion of, is there objective beauty? I think there is. So I think there's beauty, to some extent, is in the eye of the beholder. There's some subjectivity, but it's not entirely subjective because huge numbers of people, like most people, agree that certain things are beautiful. So I don't want to give the impression that beauty is entirely subjective, but still, everyone has their own taste. That's certainly true. So finding beautiful things in life, whether they're beautiful visual objects, beautiful sound could be your favorite piece of music or someone you're attached to saying that I love you too. So I mean, there's all kinds of sounds that, or some people, they say I love you, it's like, oh my God, now what do I do? You know, absolutely the worst possible person has fallen in love with me. So it just depends on your criteria. So, but in any case, the essence of who we are, what we find beautiful, what we find repulsive, what motivates us, and a lot of it's about your senses and your mind. And based on our choices, because there's a horizontal and a vertical axis when it comes to evaluating sense objects. It's clear, right, what I mean by that? Not. So, the idea is, take food for example. By horizontal I mean, there's a sense in which people make different choices, have different preferences, but you can't say one is better than another, they just have different taste. That's the horizontal thing. But there's another sense in which some choices are actually morally superior to other choices, which is of course a very almost an impudent thing to say in this highly egalitarian country, but I'll explain what I mean. So, in the case of food, let's say, for example, you like strawberries and I like peaches and someone else likes bananas. And I say, I am morally superior because I eat peaches. And to eat peaches is morally superior to eating strawberries. And it has nothing to do with strawberry, people that pick strawberries are being exploited, people that eat peaches aren't. Let's say that this has nothing to do with the ethics of the planting and harvesting and distribution and selling of these products. There's no moral issues there. In fact, let's say that my peach and your strawberries and your banana come from the same grower. Bad example, bananas are tropical. Okay, let's say they wouldn't come from the same place. My peach, your strawberries, and his apple. Let's say they all come from the same grower. And I say, no, it's just... Now, obviously, there's no moral superiority, and you can't say to someone, you know, you'd really be a better human being if you ate peaches instead of strawberries. All other things being equal. But now, let's say someone eats strawberries and someone else slaughters animals and eats them. Highly developed mammals, as you may have noticed, our country is wonderfully inconsistent, incoherent, almost schizophrenic in the attitude toward animals. So that, I know last year, the former quarterback of the Atlanta Falcons, Hare Krishna, followed very closely the NFL. The former quarterback of the Atlanta Falcons was arrested, tried, and convicted, and as we speak, is in jail. You know, the guy was making millions of dollars a year, but he is effectively in jail now. Why? Because it turned out on his land in Virginia, he was running a dog fighting thing where they would train dogs to fight each other to the death. And because perhaps he was highly competitive and wanted to be a winner, dogs that did not perform well were executed in some somewhat brutal ways. So, almost the entire nation, and I would think I would include all 50 states in this, practically the entire nation was outraged. People were just shocked and outraged by this brutality. Now, all these shocked, outraged people saw absolutely no inconsistency in getting over their shock and outrage, you know, over a good steak. It just didn't occur to them that, wait a second, these, let's say a cow, not as sexy perhaps as your little Rottweiler, but a cow, in terms of its own consciousness, is certainly as conscious as a dog. It's you know, relatively speaking, a highly developed mammal. And so, the problem is as follows. If we say that a particular creature, whether it's a human being or an animal, has rights, has certain rights, there are two possibilities, namely that the rights are intrinsic to the creature or are simply the gift of another. In other words, take the classic decadent Roman emperor. You've read Jane Eyre, you know, it's like this is kind of like the symbol of the cruel tyrant, you know, the Roman emperor throwing Christians to the lions. Anyway, I won't get into this, but Europeans are very ambivalent about classical civilization because, I mean, architecture and philosophy and literature, they love classical civilization, but they were kind of unhappy about the fact that the Romans used to throw Christians to the lions. Anyway, so ambivalence. So, you know, the classic decadent Roman emperor, he puts his thumb up, the slave lives, you've seen the Gladiator movies, you know about that. Puts his thumb down, then, you know, the person dies. Now, in that kind of, imagine what tyranny means. Imagine what autocracy really means. Autocracy means that, you know, one person has all the power, or some group has all the power, so that you, in a despotic regime, you have no intrinsic rights. the fact that you are a person, the fact that you are a human being, is like so. It's like, I just heard this great quote, it was actually in Time Magazine this last week, that they told Dick Cheney that something like 80% of the American people now were against the war in Iraq. It was some huge number, and his response was, so? Then he meant that was like, showed a lot of insight on his part. So in a tyranny, that's what a tyranny is. You do not have any intrinsic rights. The rights aren't within you, and I have to respect and honor them. All power is in the ruler, the tyrant, and if the tyrant likes you, you have rights, and if the tyrant doesn't like you, you have no rights. That is classical tyranny. Now, consider the case, I want to say a few things about rights, somehow going political here tonight, but consider an animal. There are two possibilities. That is, let's say a dog or a cow has intrinsic rights, or it's like with the cruel Roman emperor, that if we human beings like a particular animal, we put our thumbs up and that animal has rights. So that human beings can go to jail if they abuse those animals. And if we're not particularly interested in those animals, we don't bond with them, we don't have a family-type relationship, then they have no rights. So an animal's rights aren't within the animal. The animal's rights are actually within us, and we give them or withdraw them. Now, if we say that, we're not going to say it, but let's say if someone says that animals have no intrinsic rights, they have no rights within themselves, we have all the power, and we may award them certain rights. Like, for example, at this particular time in history, we like to keep dogs and cats as pets, therefore they have rights. And because most people live in cities now, and it's somewhat problematic to keep a pet cow in a city, therefore, cows are not, or certainly not bulls, are not a pet of choice. They rank down there somewhere with, boa constrictors or something. So, because we are not interested in having cows or bulls as pets, therefore they don't strike us as particularly cute. We don't bond with them. People don't put up little, sheets on utility poles and trees saying, lost Bessie the cow, she's part of the family, we can't live without her, she's so cute, call, $10 million reward. They just put it up for dogs. Actually, not sometimes for cats. I don't know. I've never, done a serious study of whether dogs or cats are more popular. But anyway, I've seen those where I was living in Southern California all the time, She's part of the family, he's my best friend. So, if you take this kind of language seriously, if you take this language as indicating something real and not just, inappropriate, silly, mushy language. If we take this language as actually meaningful, then the conclusion would be that it is possible, first of all, it means that the animals can be persons. Because, you wouldn't accept a thing in your family. You don't love things, I hope. There have been many love songs to cars in America, but on a more serious level, to say that this dog is part of my family, this cat is my best friend, means that it's a person that you have a relationship, that you've bonded. And so, now, the fact, again, going back to this principle, the fact that we don't keep pet cows and bulls right now, and therefore do not emotionally bond with them, does not mean that they have less consciousness. It does not mean they are less persons. Because being a person doesn't depend on the whim of someone else. It just depends on you being a person. So, therefore, the animal's rights are in the animal and have something to do with the animal's state of consciousness. For example, people do not put up signs on poles when they lose their pet slug. Because people don't keep slugs as pets. You hardly even see a sign for pet hamster. Maybe they just run too fast, people give up on them. But, in other words, we can see that or like I've lost my pet frog, Freddy, the more a creature has consciousness, the more we can, quote-unquote, relate to them. It doesn't mean that relatively low-level creatures are not important or have no value in God's eyes. It simply means we're talking here about not what should be, but just human psychology. What we can actually find is the more a creature has consciousness, personal consciousness, for example, dogs can exhibit traits like loyalty, affection, and so on, playfulness. So the more we can, the more they have consciousness, the more we relate to them. So therefore, it turns out to be the case that having rights has something to do with having consciousness. Now, if we say that, no, this is not the case, that we have the power to give rights to animals, they have no intrinsic rights. The problem with this is, why do human beings have intrinsic rights? Now, I would like to, I don't know how I got into this, but I'm in it. So I'll just continue. Let us compare two theories on why human beings have rights. I'll give two historical theories on why we, Homo sapiens, or wannabe sapiens, because sapien means kind of like knowing something. Latin sapere, knowing. So I'll give two theories of why we have rights as human beings. One, I think, is actually philosophically coherent. The other is philosophically incoherent, or it's just not philosophical. The first theory comes from Thomas Jefferson, who, when he wasn't impregnating his slaves, sometimes had good ideas. And the other theory comes from someone I think was not a bad guy, all in all, but quite a bit less philosophical than Jefferson, and that is Jimmy Carter, who came from just down the road a piece in Georgia. So, Jefferson claims, Jefferson gave an explanation of why we have rights, which is actually philosophically coherent. You may not believe it, but it is a consistent philosophy. Thank you, sir. Jefferson said in the Declaration of Independence, are you all following?
Yes.
Jefferson said in the Declaration of Independence that we are all created equal. He didn't say we're all born equal. He said created equal. And he said we are endowed by the Creator, with certain inalienable rights. Inalienable means no one can take them away, because they come from the top. Like you're in a company, and the owner of the company says, I'm going to increase your salary. No one else in the company can say no, because that's the person that owns the company. So Jefferson said that we are created equal, endowed by the Creator, with certain inalienable rights, life, liberty, pursuit of happiness. Now, Jimmy Carter, who is one of the best, well, up until recently, was a great ex-president. That was kind of his niche. But Jimmy Carter said, actually popularized, for those of you who are slightly younger than myself, it was during Carter's administration, Carter sort of popularized and spread around the world this notion of human rights. Because he was elected, Carter, of course, was elected in the aftermath of Tricky Dick Nixon. I remember when I was a kid, when I was in an undergraduate, and Nixon was the, she was first elected in 68. Yeah, my last year or two before I joined a dangerous cult, I was an undergraduate at Berkeley. And you see these posters all over. They have like a picture of Nixon's face, and then underneath it would say, would you buy a used car from this man? And looked at the picture, and I was like, I don't think so. But anyway, oh, he did a lot of good things. I don't want to just be unkind to Richard Nixon. He did. But anyway, after Nixon, people were really, and then of course, Ford came along. That's just one funny, I'll tell one funny Ford story, Gerald Ford. After he was president, a little while after he was president, one time he was flying into some airport, I think it was Denver, Los Angeles. And at that, there was a Krishna guru coming at the same time. So all these devotees were there, and they were chanting and dancing, a big thing. and Ford happening in the same flight. So, you know, he's so used to the whole political thing that when he came through the tunnel, he thought it was for him. The doors were all chatting, so he was like smiling, waving, went into his thing, and which was nice. I mean, it was a nice thing he did that. And, yeah, he got to hear the chanting of Hare Krishna. So, anyway, after Nixon and then Ford, of course, and Ford was sort of not electable again because one of his first acts upon assuming the presidency was to pardon Nixon of any possible crimes. So then the country really wanted to return. I guess you guys weren't like really up and at 'em back then, right? You were engaged in
different bodies.
Engaged in, yeah, at least, yeah, you were doing some other frivolous things. So, anyway, at that point, people were very cynical. There was a real anti-authority thing in America. There was, like, tremendous, there was all kinds of articles, everybody talked about it. There was, like, real cynicism. No one trusted the authorities because of Nixon. So then Jimmy Carter came along, and, you know, he slept with the Bible under his pillow and prayed a lot, and just folks. And so he got elected. Anyway, so he was kind of sort of riding this wave of moral renewal, and so he started pushing the idea of human rights as a way of America kind of getting some moral leverage against other countries in the world. Now, what's interesting is that for all his piety, Carter's argument was basically humanistic. I mean, it really wasn't an argument at all. It was just a declaration that anyone who is anatomically human has certain rights. If you have a human anatomy, you've got rights. So, now if you think about this, which everyone assumes, of course, human rights, but if you think about it, what is there about the human anatomy that produces rights? If you look at Western philosophy, probably the philosopher who could most blow up this theory, like very quickly, would be David Hume, the Scottish skeptic of the late 18th century, who kind of scandalized Europe with his agnostic views. Anyway, one of the points that Hume made, which is really, I think, knocks out poor Jimmy, is that you cannot derive a metaphysical fact from a physical fact. Now, meta in Greek means beyond or after, so metaphysical means that which is beyond the physical. So, for example, it is a physical fact. It is a physical fact that you have a human body. That is a physical fact that you right now are operating within a human body and doing business as a human being. So that's a physical fact. Now, to say that you have a right, it's a metaphysical claim. Because after all, what is a right? Like, can someone bring a right in here and we'll look at it and see what color it is or weigh it or measure it in some other way? So what is a right? What Hume is pointing out is that, well, he didn't just talk about rights because that's kind of like more what we do. We talk about our rights. He might have talked about justice, but to say that we have a right. But one question you could ask is, how do you know that? How do you know we have rights? You can say, well, I just feel it. Something deep inside cannot be denied or something like that. You know, you can get poetic on us. Try to move us to tears. But, as Hume pointed out, how do you derive, if you look at the human body, if you look at all the organs, you know, get one of those little visible man dolls they used to have. They still have those for kids? Where it's like the outer surface of a human body is like transparent plastic, and then kids build a human body.
Yeah.
It's called the visible... Well, of course, now they couldn't say visible man. They have to have visible woman, too, because for obvious reasons. So, anyway, if you look at a human body, anyone here, if you can think of what organ is it that produces the rights, and how does it produce a right? I mean, it's certainly not your elbows. I have elbows, therefore I have rights. I mean, that doesn't sound very logical. So, now you could say, I have a brain, which would put you in this world in, of course, a very elite minority of human beings. So, but let's say you claim that I have a brain, then, and, what if you're not using it? What if someone is impaired? What if someone is brain impaired? Are they potentially dinner? So if you, how do you say that a right, which is a value, a metaphysical, it's a non-physical value, it's just, you know, what's a value? It somehow emanates from a physical structure, like blood cells, heart, I mean, where does it come from? So when you think about this, to claim that we have rights because we have human anatomies, we are anatomically human, therefore we have rights, is, it's not coherent. It's not clear what it really means. There's a lot of things that sound good, they're great sound bites, but they're bad philosophy. And I think Jimmy came up with one. Great sound bite, bad philosophy. So if you go back and look at Jefferson, he said, we have rights, not because we're anatomically human, but because the Creator, who's the highest authority, endowed us with those rights. So therefore, unlike Carter, Jefferson derives a metaphysical fact, we have rights, from what he claims to be another metaphysical fact, namely the Creator endowed us in this way. Therefore, Jefferson, who was actually very bright and the people that founded the country, at least many of them, like John Adams and Jefferson, were among the most highly educated people in many centuries. They were extremely highly, I mean, they were educated in a way that hardly anyone is nowadays. So anyway, so Jefferson, who was aware of Hume, derived a metaphysical claim from another metaphysical claim. Not from, you see the point? Going back to animals and former quarterbacks and all that, and cows. The rights of animals cannot merely depend upon our whims. Because it seems to me, if you're going to be rational and consistent, if the rights of animals depend on our whims, why don't the rights of humans depend on our whims? In other words, how would you distinguish? We have overwhelming evidence that human beings themselves often consider certain animals to also be persons. They form emotional relationships with them, and sometimes take them to psychiatrists, leave the money in their will. I'm Southern California, so nothing is impossible in Southern California. So therefore, if you say that animals' rights come from humans, why don't human rights come from humans? Then you just have good old-fashioned tyranny. If you say we have rights because we're humans, then what does that mean? Then you fall into the trap again. You're trying to derive a metaphysical fact from a physical fact. If you say that you link rights to consciousness, you say, well, because human beings are more intelligent than animals, which of course would be a very controversial claim nowadays, but let's say that you do claim that human beings are more intelligent than animals, then what about human beings that aren't intelligent? Like maybe you have rights if you get over a certain number on your SAT or some other test, and, it's good, you know, and if you get under a certain score, then you're basically, you can be hunted or herded into a slaughterhouse and used to alleviate, I don't know, international food shortage or something. So, otherwise we're left with a kind of just herd, for example, let's say if you look at gnus or other very popular creatures, or you know, any kind of creature, they herd together, and you know, the herd defends the herd. I saw this; you can see that. And, you know, there's a herding tendency among creatures, and they, especially mammals, and they sort of gather together when they're being attacked by predators, and they defend them, their herd. So is our awarding of rights to humans nothing more than a primitive, beastly urge the same that any, you know, group of beasts? In other words, we don't really have rights. Are we prepared to say that? Because some people try to derive all this in evolution. We've evolved in the way that evolution is like God. It explains everything. In fact, it eliminates the need to think about anything. You can just attribute it to evolution. But the idea of here being that we evolved that way. But in that case, we don't really have rights. See, if you want to attribute our, like we have the instinct, we believe we have rights just because we evolved that way. Although I don't think it does, because I think what we're finding now, if you compare the U.S. and the Chinese economy, it seems like closed societies have certain distinct survival advantages, which is why the Chinese government probably owns the U.S. government now, with bonds. So, if you study history, it is not at all clear that liberal, open societies that recognize all kinds of human rights survive better, are more efficient. That is not clear. It's just not clear from a study of history. It's just kind of like sentimental belief system. But in any case, even if it turned out to be the case, even if it turned out to be the case that societies that recognize human rights somehow have a survival advantage over tyrannies, which, as I said, I'm not at all sure of, but even if it were the, historically, but even if it were the case, then you'd be left with a situation that we don't really have rights. We don't really have rights. It's just, we're just programmed by evolution to think we do. And the programming is practical, so just go with the programming. Is that really what we feel in our heart? In your heart, do you really feel that no one has any rights? That if someone walks up to an innocent person and bludgeons them to death or rapes them or does something like that, there's nothing really wrong with that. It's just we're programmed to think that's wrong. Is that really what you think about acts of cruelty and malice? They're not really wrong. Because if we say that we're just programmed to think that we have rights, then if I can prove through a study of history that there were many successful tyrants, and if I can convince you, therefore, to usurp power and kill all your enemies, and what if it turns out to be pragmatic? Like, what if, in fact, you study history, there are many cases where cruel and barbarous regimes impose their will, and that was that. So why do human beings have rights? If it's linked to consciousness, then people with more consciousness should have more rights. If it's linked to consciousness, animals should have certain rights because they have a certain amount of consciousness. And even if you say rights are linked to consciousness, I could just say, why? Why? What if I claim, no, they're not. You can be a genius and you're still, you know, I'm just going to turn you into, put you in my microwave. And so a bumper sticker in Charlottesville, Virginia. What did it say? It said, do not meddle in the affairs of dragons. Do not meddle in the affairs of dragons. You are crunchy and taste good with ketchup. So, a little sick, but... So my point is, why, as human beings, we have rights? Where do rights come from? Again, Jefferson said we're endowed by the Creator. If we give up Jefferson's logic, what do you have left?
Because we're Americans.
Okay, that trumps everything. Jimmy, though, said human rights. Yes?
He's saying maybe the Bible, I can't remember like how it says the states of good, says that when God created man, then it gave him the rule over everything.
Dominion. Dominion. Yeah, dominion. Yeah, but parents have dominion over their children, but they don't eat them, hopefully. Good parents don't eat their children. To have dominion, parents have dominion over children. The Constitution gives the government a certain dominion over the citizens. Should the government eat the citizens? I guess if there weren't term limits, we might come to that. So, Well, didn't actually get to the topic I claimed I was going to talk on. But, it could be like an angry stampede of irate customers demanding their money back. So, anything else on these points?
I was thinking when you were talking about the idea of why is one animal, you know, attractive and one and the other. And I remember Prabhupada, one of the speakers, there was one point he made that animal provides sense gratification in one form as a dog, you know, because that dog gives us a sense of control, like, you know.
Affection, loyalty.
And all that. And in the form of a cow, it's also sense gratification, but in the form of a steak. So the ultimate issue is whatever gets in my way, let me conquer it in this way or that way. So but sense gratification was the center criteria for that. So one...
Selfishness.
Yes.
Yeah, that was my point. The Roman Empire, yes. You know, emperor, thumbs up or down. So, yeah, do rights... If we say that rights just come from the selfishness of a tyrant, whether it can be a tyrant who actually controls a government, or maybe a tyrant that kills an animal, shoots an animal, or... So there should be a standardizing of the legal system to bestow, to lavish affection and rights and consideration, moral consideration, on one creature, and to just systematically brutalize and murder another creature that has the same level of consciousness with no explanation. Is grossly incoherent. So in this country, and I suppose in many countries, probably most, the legal attitude toward animals is very inconsistent, incoherent. So there's, you know, there's sexism, there's racism, and the next moral frontier is, I think, speciesism. After all, what is racism? It means that if someone's in this race has a right to manipulate another race, exploit another race, because the exploiting race has power. And I don't speak in America, it happens everywhere. America, it happens in Africa, South America, I mean, all over the world you find this. So, sexism is the idea that this sex, this gender, has the right to dominate or exploit this other gender. So similarly, the idea that this species, like if you're human, you have a right to dominate and exploit other species, is just, speciesism. It's the law of the jungle, might makes right. So because we have power over animals, whatever we do is right.
Would then be wrong to use animals, you know, for farming or for transportation? You know, we'd be exploiting them in a sense.
It would be if you're not otherwise, let's say, engaged in spiritual activities. Now, certain animals we call domestic animals actually, if they're treated properly, live better under human care than they would in the wild. They're safer. They're guaranteed regular food. In terms of, what was that book? Pie something? Yeah, there's some novel. In terms of the animal's needs, now we may have some like romantic, you know, maybe like we may have Mel Gibson in our head, you know, freedom, like that movie Braveheart. So, but from the animal's point of view, it's not about Mel Gibson. I think some animals are more rational than Mel Gibson. But from the animal's point of view, it's about security. It's about 3 squares a day being fed properly. Animals are not, don't have the same sort of political sensitivities we may have. Certain animals do. So there are certain domestic animals who, if they're treated appropriately, actually have a better life, working in cooperation with human beings. Working in cooperation. And they're not simply the slaves of human beings. They're souls who happen to be in that particular body, and they are engaged in serving humanity's interests, and in return, human beings look after their interests. It's more of a cooperative. It's a partnership. And the people, the human beings who are engaging the animals in this partnership, should offer the fruits of that work to God, so that animals also are engaged in service to God. An animal also can have a spiritual life. If you are engaged in spiritual activities, if you are, say, producing food, and you're offering that food to God, seriously, making a sacred offering, then the animal that helped produce that food is engaged in spiritual activities and will benefit and will make spiritual advancement. And actually, in the future, that the soul and that animal body will be elevated. So the nice thing about a spiritual society is that every creature is elevated. Every creature evolves spiritually. I was making that point that personally, I don't find the wilderness that charming. I'm from the Western United States. I've seen a lot of wilderness and rugged scenery and all that stuff. And it is very spectacular, but it's also, I find it a little boring. Because specifically in the Western United States, as you see, I will not be hired as an ambassador spokesperson for the Western United States. But I find it a little boring after a while, in the sense that we live in a space-time continuum, as you all know. And it's sort of, it can be inspiring to see a great deal of space, like from a mountaintop, let's say, a very common thing, if anyone's in the West, very common thing, like you can see 50 or 100 miles, like you'll see a distant mountain or something. In the Eastern United States, because you can't get up so high most of the time, and the air is a little more humid, but there's still some good views. But anyway, when you think of the space-time continuum, a truly inspiring experience is not merely to see far spatially, but also temporally, to see far into time. And so, a civilization that has an interesting history, cultural history, actually allows you to see time depth, not only space depth. I don't know why I just mentioned that, why I'm doing that to the Western United States, but... So, why no? Because sometimes people are so fed up with stupid human behavior and trashing the Earth planet and all that, that they just want to get away to the wilderness. I'm like, thanks for sharing. They want to get away where there's like no visible signs of humanity. There's no trace of human beings. But I think there's the other extreme. Human beings are, when they are sane, which occasionally happens, human beings are also part of nature if they're behaving appropriately. As much as squirrels or pigeons or elephants or whatever else. So human beings living appropriately, naturally, are not only part of nature, they're actually an important part of nature. And appropriate human constructions, cottages, little bridges over burbling brooks. I mean, there are certain kinds of human productions which are actually natural, and to remove them, like to want to, let's say, be in the... I mean, I'm not saying that wilderness is evil or anything, but there's something natural and balanced about nature and having natural human beings doing what they do. So that some people feel that all human productions are somehow evil and invasive and somehow disturb everything. But there is a way to live as a human being where your human contribution actually enhances nature, makes nature more beautiful. So same thing with domestic animals. In other words, we shouldn't... It's like an equal and opposite reaction. Some people are so burned out, so fed up with human overbearing human activities that they just want to be in the wilderness where there's no trace of humanity. But there's also something unnatural about that for us. Because human beings actually exist. And if they integrate themselves with nature, it's actually, they're part of the natural scene. To say an appropriate human dwelling, like using natural elements and building just an appropriate human dwelling, is as natural as a bird building a nest. And to me, it looks as natural. So the same thing, there is a natural relationship between human beings and animals. There are animals who are naturally partners with human beings. And both the animal and the human beings benefit by the partnership. Yes, ma'am.
You were talking about the horizontal and vertical.
Yes. Yes, yes.
What's the vertical?
Oh, the vertical is, for example, if one person, let's say two people have a cow. One person takes the milk from the cow, as you may know if you've ever been in a dairy situation, that it's actually good for the cow to take some of the milk, because if the calf drinks all the milk, the cow will basically, it's like you, say, you're going totally out of control with Baskin-Robbins. You know, waking up in the hospital. So therefore, and the cow has to be milked. Otherwise, it's not good for the cow not to be milked. The cow needs to be milked. And the calf can't drink all the milk. So two people have a cow. One of them milks the cow and protects the cow in gratitude, takes care of this cow. Another person has a cow and brutally murders it. So those two acts are not morally equal. To work in partnership with another creature is not on the same moral level as brutally murdering that creature. They're just different. One is morally superior. To receive a gift and offer back in return is superior to stealing from someone and then killing the person. They're just on a different moral level. Whereas, let's say, for example, the same thing. Let's say we both have fruit trees. Let's say you like apples and I like peaches, or someone else likes pears. There's no moral distinction. It's not a moral issue. That's just taste. So to say everyone has their own view, everyone has their own taste, fine, if we're on the same moral level. But if we're on different moral levels, then it's not just you have your opinion, I have mine. There's actually an objective difference. So that's the vertical axis. So any other question? Yes?
What about, other living entities like plants, which we uproot sometimes.
Yes. The fact is we have to eat organic matter. You can't eat plastic bags, although some people may not believe we can because they put them on trees. They just blow there. So we have to eat organic matter. Now, let's say you go to the doctor. Let's say you have something that needs to be treated. You go to a doctor. I won't get into which pathic it is, because let's say you go to a doctor. And now, let's say you go to a competent doctor. So he or she knows what they're doing. They're actually going to treat you and help you. Now, we expect not only the doctor will give the right treatment or an effective treatment. We expect on moral grounds that the doctor will treat me in the least invasive, least painful way possible. If you go to a doctor and you're treated and it caused you a lot of pain, the doctor says, yeah, but I helped you, But the doctor did not choose the least painful method. There was actually another method which was just as effective and much less painful. We would hold that the doctor is acting immorally to unnecessarily cause us pain or cause pain to someone we love or to anyone. So the same way, we have to feed ourselves. We have to feed ourselves, but we should do it in a way which causes least pain to other creatures. Now, someone may argue, for example, that potatoes are just as conscious as cows. That's why they have eyes. But, I mean, there's sort of the people who say, well, for all we know, you know, dolphins are actually more intelligent than humans, are actually having very sophisticated conversations and discussing all kinds of philosophical topics. However, all these ideas, like maybe potatoes are more conscious, all these ideas are based on a severing of behavior from consciousness. In other words, if we say that behavior tells us nothing about consciousness, then yeah, maybe for example, there's a cactus growing in Arizona that, you know, knows more than all the great philosophers of history. Maybe there's even like a peanut that's actually the most intelligent person on earth right now. But that's very unlikely. So I think it's reasonable for us to insist on some type of relationship between behavior and consciousness. These two are, in fact, somehow related. So we have to eat organic matter. Can't eat inorganic matter. Just doesn't do the job. And yet, it is ordained by God that we feed ourselves, that we nourish ourselves in a way which causes least pain to other creatures. Causes the least pain to other creatures. And that's not enough. Even that's not enough. We have to offer our food to God. It becomes spiritualized. And let's say a potato, the lowly but nonetheless courageous potato, when it's offered to God, make a food offering, then the soul in that starchy apparatus, the soul in there is benefited, actually gets the blood, is engaged directly in spiritual activities. And so the soul in that body, that potato, is tremendously benefited. Much more than if you let the potato rot in the ground, which it would. Actually, if you didn't pick it. If I had the misfortune of, I don't know, somehow or other my karma brought me down to potatohood, and I had the choice of being uprooted at the end of my life cycle, being uprooted and offered to God, and then being, maybe perhaps taking birth as a human being with a chance to be spiritual, or having a few more, you know, very, very short additional time of potatohood and then rotting in the ground, I think I'd go for the God option. So I think it's dramatically in the self-interest of a soul in potatoed, you know, it's tremendously the advantage of that soul to be offered literally on a silver platter to God or to Krishna. It's just much better for that soul. And we have to eat something. And there's some food, like we can take fruit without injuring the tree and so on. But there has to be a sense, you know, it's interesting because in ancient cultures they really had this sensitivity. If you look at, let's say, certain indigenous peoples of the Amazon jungle, if you look at ancient South Indian culture, I mean, you see this everywhere. I'll give you a few examples. For example, in certain indigenous American communities that used to, you know, have a lot of territory before the Europeans came and improved them. Let's say, for example, you wanted to build a canoe, because especially if you look at certain parts, I mean, there's a you know, the whole Amazon River system. Obviously, a canoe is the, you know, it's like the car of choice. I mean, a Lexus isn't going to be much good in some of these jungles. So, they would go to the forest to cut down a tree to make a canoe, and they had to ask permission from the goddess of the forest. Environmentally, very sound. If you have to ask permission from a forest goddess, you can't, you know, there's no question of clear-cutting, or, you know, like, let's cut a million trees for our latest junk mail thing. You can't do stuff like that. It's inappropriate. It's like you can't go to your neighbor's house, you know, and blow your nose on their curtains. It's just inappropriate. Sorry for that shocking and depressing example, but everyone's thinking, oh my God, I wonder if someone's broken into my home right now is on my curtain. So, I remember when I did my doctoral work, I remember one book I read, and in South India, in certain communities in South India, when they wanted to build a temple, a new temple, which in Sanskrit they called Deva Griha, which literally means the house of God. They, of course, whenever you build anything, you have to level the land. I mean, it's not a great idea to build on unlevel land. So to clear the land in those days, they didn't have tractors. So the Vedic tractor, of course, was the ox plow. So you had to build a new plow because you can't level the land for the house of God with the plow you use for your own stuff. So you have to build a new plow. To make a new plow, you got to cut a tree down. So they would go into the forest, and they were keenly aware that every tree, actually one of the words for tree in Sanskrit is Vanaspati, namely the forest lord, the lord of the forest, the tower over the forest. Vanaspati, lord of the forest. And every tree, every such tree, is actually a complete community. Because it's not only the tree, there are, you know, there's squirrels and snakes and insects and birds and all kinds of creatures take shelter under the tree, feed off of the tree. It's just, so a tree is a community, is the center of a community. And so you had to sincerely beg forgiveness from that community. And you had to show sincere concern for those souls. Like, you had to pray for them. Pray that somehow they would be compensated for the trouble you'd caused them. That considering the fact that this tree is being used to make a plow to level the land for the house of God, considering all that, may these souls who are being, in the case of the tree, killed, or in the case of the birds or squirrels, inconvenienced, may these creatures be compensated for their service to God, because they've all made a sacrifice in God's service. And in the of course, they would cut the tree and make the plow. But this level of awareness, obviously, in environmental terms, it's the best thing since sliced chapatis. So, I mean, from the environmental standpoint, it's just what the doctor ordered, isn't it? And it shows an awareness. As some people have argued, we need to reanimate nature. If you look at how people used to think. People used to live in a universe which was full of life, full of spirits, full of all kinds of life, full of God's energy. People, that's the world people lived in. And then the world was, what's the word? Not deanimated, but disenchanted. In a certain point with the rise of, not just the rise of science, but the rise of sort of vain, arrogant, atheistic science, the world was sort of disenchanted. And the world has to be re-enchanted in the sense that we have to now, if you look at little children when they draw pictures in school, like they put a smiling face on a house, on the sun. And so, are they infantile, or have they retained a certain deep awareness that they lose as they grow up? Because they see, think of children, they see everything as a person. A house is a person, a son is a person, man, everything's a person. If you look at cartoons, isn't everything's animated? It's animated cartoons, not only in the sense that the figures move, but there's animated also in the literal sense from the Greek, like Aristotle's word, the animated, in the sense everything has a soul, everything is a person. And that's how innocent creatures, unpolluted by lust and other mind-suffocating forms of selfishness, that's how these innocent creatures see the universe as intensely personal. Intensely personal. That we live... So actually, we need to open our eyes and see that actually we are in an enchanted world right now. You don't have to go to Middle Earth. I mean, in a sense, we are in Middle Earth. Because the world is enchanted. The world is animated. We just have to recognize it. And that's what Krishna says in the Gita. I am one who sees me everywhere. And sees everything in me is the true yogi. That's the true yogi. Is there anything else?
Maybe you could, it's late, right?
Yes, it's late.
Maybe you could count out the
time. Yes, that's a good idea. Yeah, it is late, my God. So a little kirtan, do you have any...
Would you like?
Do you have a drum?
Thank you.